Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode 25. I'm Rob Wright, editor of Search Security, and I'm here as usual with my site editor, Peter Loschen. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Rob.
How's it going this week?
Great.
We've been really busy. I should say you've been really busy, and Mike Keller, our news reporter, has also been pretty busy. We've got a lot of...
You've been pretty busy, too.
Well, I've been busy with other stuff. I mean, yes, I've been very busy. But, yeah, busy kind of freaking out about all the different vulnerabilities and exploits and DDoS attacks and so on and so forth. I guess we should probably start at the top and revisit the topic. I mean, it feels like we were just talking about this because we were. We recorded our podcast this week. We're recording this on Friday, the 28th of October. We were in here on Monday at the start of the week, kind of recapping what had happened last Friday on the DDoS attack against Dyn, the DNS provider, which sort of caused major disruptions and sort of intermittent downtime for a number of major websites. And we kind of recapped what we knew at the time, what we thought might be happening, what I thought might be happening. And so we have more information, and it turns out, we have a little bit more, I guess, clarity from some different companies about what was going on with these attacks in terms of who was behind them and the motivations, which we'll get into. But to summarize, I guess my theory about what was going on got blown to pieces, which is hardly a surprise. But I guess...
Remind me, Rob, what was your theory?
My theory was that this could have been, I guess it wasn't a theory, it was more of a suggestion. I said in the previous podcast that the sort of the intent, the motive kind of left me a little befuddled, and this could be a situation where some hackers were almost sort of acting, initiated this DDoS attack as sort of a wake-up call to get companies to get their act together about the IoT devices, the DDoS mitigation, the DNS infrastructure, DNS architecture, the fact that you can target some of these DNS providers and bring down large swaths of the internet. So, but it turns out that that is likely not the case. And again, we can get into that in a moment, but do you want to kind of recap? You've wrote a number of pieces about multiple pieces about this through the week as things were unfolding. So what do we know at this point about what went on? What are some of the findings that have trickled out?
As with any of these kinds of events, everybody throws their arms up and runs around screaming and panicking.
That was me.
Yes. But you weren't alone.
Yeah.
There were others with you, but... You know, so late Friday afternoon, the magnitude of this whole thing became apparent.
Yep.
After I went home, of course.
Right.
But
which we,
yeah. Right. We probably talked about that on Monday. I have no recollection of that.
It's been that kind of week.
Well, okay. So apparently, a roughly 7-ish in the morning.
Yeah.
Dyn engineers detected that there was something happening.
Right.
They were getting elevated traffic, and I'm referring to my memory of the analysis that Scott Hilton from Dyn put out, and that came out just the other day.
Right.
So this was after a while. So the initial report said that they had observed tens of millions of IP addresses. So that's part of the thing that got everybody running around panicking. That number, it turns out now, that the thought is that no more than about 100,000 Mirai botnets devices had been participating in this attack. And the number of IP addresses was, you know, as we had previously mentioned in one of my stories from this week, that was just, it didn't represent reality. It was just something, you know, an artifact of the attack. So 100,000 botnet, 100,000 strong botnet attack. There was elevated traffic, and then all of a sudden they got massive attacks on their infrastructure in the east of the United States, and they mitigated. After about 2 hours, they mitigated the first attack. They used, now I wish I could figure out where my last story was, where I detailed all this, but so after a couple of hours, they mitigated it. They used, you know, they had automatic mitigation techniques that, that kick in automatically, but that wasn't enough. So they had to, the engineers had to go ahead and do, I believe it was, they did things like traffic shaping.
Yep.
And other networky technical stuff that they did. So they mitigated the first attack after about 2 hours. They mitigated the second attack with relatively minimal effect on their customers and their and users. And then the third attack didn't really register at all. The right. third wave, which right. which came Friday late afternoon or evening. So what have we learned? We've learned James Clapper, National Director of Intelligence, came out and basically said this is not a state-sponsored attack, as have a Flashpoint also came out with that. The general consensus at this point is that it may have been script kiddies who may have been targeting.
I guess Flashpoint was also one of the sources that said that it looked like this might have been sort of just low-level quote-unquote hackers on hackforums.net that had initiated the attack, which makes sense because the Mirai botnet code had been released on the hacker or hack forums by an individual not too long ago. And then one of there were many sites, I think, that Flashpoint sort of cited in terms of being on the Dyn DNS network and that were affected by the attacks. But one that caught my attention was, so it could have been anything, right? We don't know. It could have, it Reddit was on there. You could have some disgruntled Reddit users who maybe got banned and decided to, we're going to show Reddit. But one that caught my attention was the online video game RuneScape. Is a it's a fantasy MMO RPG, and the game has a history of people trying to DDoS it, I guess, or at least claiming they're going to DDoS it. There's a lot of that sort of behavior and chatter out there. I hope this isn't a case where like some younger kids got together and said, well, we're gonna mess with this game for whatever reason, whether they were members of RuneScape themselves, players of RuneScape themselves, who knows. But it's little things like that, you know, that came out of Flashpoint's report about, you know, where the chatter and the activity about these attacks that kind of lead them to believe it was just script kiddies.
Some dummies.
Which, I mean, that may be a little strong because they were, whoever did it, if let's say they were low-level hackers, black hats, whatever you want to call them, you can call them script kiddies, but they were smart enough to apparently sit down and say, well, going right at a website that's probably protected by Akamai or whoever, that's for the birds. Let's take this botnet. Let's try to get, leverage some devices, enough devices. We'll go right at the DNS provider and we'll take down not only the site we want to take down, but we'll take down others as well. And we'll, be headline heroes. And so, I guess you got to give them some credit for thinking outside the box. Not that they invented, attacks on DNS providers. That's been going on for a while, but yeah. So Clapper said, you were saying Clapper said something.
Clapper said, so he basically said The investigation is still going on. There's a lot of data to be gathered. But basically what he said is that it points to a non-state actor.
Yeah.
Flashpoint also, I think, supported that. The thing that I'm reminded of, there's a saying that the first reports are always wrong.
Mm.
And, you know, when I picked up, when I started looking at the Twitter feed on late on Friday afternoon after I was home, and I saw people saying, oh, the internet is exploding, the internet is burning down, all these things, that was a little extreme. I think we're going to find some troubling pieces of information as we learn more and more. Our weekly roundup this week started out with a pretty good coverage of the latest.
Yeah.
But of course, since I filed that story, I spotted something that indicated that maybe 100,000 devices is an overstatement.
It
might have been less.
Yeah.
It might have been 40,000. Which is, 40,000, 100,000, still same
true
order of magnitude.
But that's still troubling in the sense that, and this kind of gets into sort of more of the specifics here, but that's troubling because you can still do that level of damage with an even smaller number of devices. So let's say somebody does get 100,000 devices. I mean, one of the things that you point out in your story, I think it's the most recent one, the soon-to-be published one, is that, you referenced Scott Hilton, the executive vice president of products at Dyne, and one of the things they said was, that he said in the blog post, the update, he said there have been reports of a magnitude in the 1.2 terabyte per second range. At this time, we're unable to verify that claim. But he did say that their data centers were getting, quote, packet flow bursts 40 to 50 times higher than normal. Okay, that's a lot. And, he goes on in that post to say a significant portion of the traffic never actually reached Dyne due to their own mitigation efforts, which is great. That's great news. However, if it's only 40 or 50,000, what happens when they get 100,000? What happens when they get more? I know a lot of these devices are being recalled. I know that there's probably a lot more vulnerable devices. We've talked about the OpenSSH flaw, the Showdown mm-hmm. proxy flaw that Akamai uncovered that allowed people to get into different IoT devices, different internet-connected devices and take control of them through something as simple as an SSH tunnel, which a lot of these devices don't need to have. They don't need that functionality. So let's say that number is lower. I almost think that's worse.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line of this for me, the takeaway after a week of looking at this stuff pretty much every day and digging into it.
You've been living this.
Well, yeah, partially. But the bottom line, so there's, on the one hand, on the upside, on the optimist side, I can say, okay, this was a pretty big attack, and yet it still was mitigated within a couple of hours, pretty much.
Yeah.
Overall impact on my life?
Right. Small.
Small. Yeah, exactly.
Small.
It was minimal. Small. It was sort of like, what happens when your internet goes down at home and you have to wait for somebody to come in.
Right, but that's your own private misery.
That's right. But
was a shared misery.
This was a shared misery, but it was, if I remember correctly, it might have been a kind of a nice day on last Friday.
I was at home trying to reconnect to I almost said the name of the cloud service we use. Not going to do that.
Well,
not going to say that, but not to go into too much detail about our own ops here at TechTarget, but I mean, I had trouble getting into that particular service. We do need Twitter to perform some of our job functions. So we maintain a social media presence for TechTarget and search security. And but you're right.
But yeah, I mean, I said I was sitting on my porch with a beverage.
Chilling.
And a snack. And the birds were flying around and, a lot of the trees are still green around here, even though it's November almost. But, it was a nice afternoon. I was sitting out there. I was looking at Twitter. when I could.
Right.
And which was mostly
with okay. No pictures or links.
But, with yeah. No pictures or links. Yeah. But it was, you know, the overall impact. So that's the optimist in me speaking.
Right.
The pessimist will turn around and say, yeah, this was just a bunch of, you know, presumably, you know, when we say non-state actors, we're talking about people with limited resources.
True, true.
So it's clearly not the thing that Bruce Schneier was warning us about last month when he wrote his piece about somebody secretly testing.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. So, you know, if it's on the downside, yeah, we could.
So the worst may be to come.
The worst is always to come.
Well, thanks.
There's always, you know, no matter how bad things get, they can always get worse.
It's heating up here in Chernobyl. I'm starting to get a little panicky. I'm gonna loosen the collar.
But how is that different from any other time?
No. It's true, and you bring up a great point about Schneier. I mean, I think we've talked about this a number of times, this post from Bruce about on Lawfare blog about, you know, his discussions behind the scenes with different internet companies about, you know, a number of sort of attacks or efforts to test the defenses of companies that maintain critical infrastructure on the internet. And you've got to believe that DNS providers are probably in that camp, as well as large companies that provide CDN or DDoS mitigation services. The thing that is troubling to me, in addition to that, so let's say these kids or these sort of, you know, non-state actors that were just apparently doing this for kicks or had some, you know, minor agenda. So they weren't really trying to bring down the internet. But certainly this indicates that the possibility is there for a wider scale campaign to be performed using this type of stuff. Maybe not just the Mirai botnet, but that's something I guess we should clarify, because even, you know, I believe in Hilton's post, in his update, he says a significant amount of the traffic was generated from the Mirai botnet, but they still don't, it's not totally clear what else was sort of involved there.
Well,
there could have been other sources.
Yeah, I mean, part of the fallout of an attack like that is that legitimate users trying to get access to the DNS who are blocked, they're going to just keep, you know, like they're computers.
Right.
They just do what they do.
Yeah.
And part of what they do is if they can't reach something, they just keep trying.
Yeah.
So if you have a lot of legitimate users trying to update their DNS or to get a DNS query done, they're going to keep hitting those servers that aren't responding. And that's going to generate a lot of friendly fire kind of...
Retry storm,
exactly. One other thought I want to toss in there is...
Yes.
Listening and reading and looking at what a lot of these intelligence talking heads are telling us...
Yes. Like government intelligence or threat intelligence, security intelligence?
You know, I'm okay, talking about... And it sort of blends together, but we've heard a lot from Clapper, from Admiral Rogers,
mm-hmm.
From, you know, any number of these folks who have experience with this through the military. We've got a lot of military and national intelligence operatives, and so does China, and so mm-hmm. does Russia, and so does Israel and Iran, North Korea, and any number of other countries as well.
Mm-hmm.
Their job is to carry out, well, let's just call it cyber, you know, cyber warfare or whatever.
Cyber attacks.
And in fact, I wanted to raise one piece of news that came up this week was that Cyber Command.
Oh yeah.
Is now operational.
Yep.
They've got 133 units. They've got about 5,000 staff, and all of those units are operational, and they're going to come fully online. Their schedule is for about a year from now. So what are those people going to be doing? They're not going to be sitting on their thumbs waiting for something to happen. They're going to be running drills. They're going to be running war games. They're going to be running all kinds of things. Part of their job, and one of the things that I was struck by our intelligence leaders was that they said, this is what countries do. They probe.
Yeah.
They check. They test. You know, there was a little dam over in, I want to say, Rye, New York, earlier this year, maybe into the last year, where we found out that I think it was Iranian hackers were probing it. I mean, they're just poking around. They're poking around. They're testing because they want to see where does our influence end and where does your influence begin.
Sure.
So there's nothing that tells me that this couldn't have been the work of somebody at Cyber Command, for example, or at the Chinese equivalent or the Israeli equivalent.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. I mean, yeah, this could have been something that just got out of hand a little bit. It could have been something that it could have been probing. It could have been checking to see how Dyne's defenses worked.
Yeah.
Probably not. Right. Well, in another week, we're going to have another conversation about this, I bet. We're going to have a whole different set of pieces of information. And in a month, and in 6 months, and in a year, we're going to have, the details are going to trickle out.
Yeah.
Maybe. And we'll get more perspective on it. And we'll, this will just be another thing like, another massive thing like the OPM breach, which we keep talking about, but
kind of a benchmark type thing that we make callbacks to and says, remember when this happened. And I think you're right. I'll close with this. The thing that I find interesting is that, one of the discussions about cloud services, using infrastructure as a service, computing as a service, excess server capacity, that sort of thing. One of the concerns that a lot of people had over the years and discussed in terms of theoretical cloud breaches was, well, can you imagine if someone got into, an AWS environment and was able to move laterally and co-opt, or compromise multiple instances and gain a lot of computing power and use that to do a major DDoS that had the sort of theoretical potency of tens of millions of IP addresses, which I guess we should clarify that according to Dyne, the tens of millions that got pared down, obviously, because of the retry storm. They had trouble distinguishing who was legit trying to get access to the DNS service and who was bombarding it with malicious traffic. So, but that sort of concern was always there for a lot of security folks, a lot of enterprises, a lot of the cloud providers was, we don't want this power of infrastructure as a service falling into the wrong hands and now having it used maliciously in any capacity, whether it's staging command and control for malware or whatever, or actually using the computing resources to conduct a DDoS attack. It's so bizarre to me to look at that now and say, we really haven't had many instances of that or like many examples of that where huge amounts of computing power have been sort of stolen and used against us. I don't think we've had anything like this, but here we are talking about cloud up here, the most sort of powerful and complex systems in the world running on cloud computing, and then down here you've got literally the dumbest and most insecure and most limited functionality devices that we have that we make sort of working against us. So it's like we were worried about X. We were worried about A up here at the top of the alphabet, and we're dealing with X down at the bottom. There's some irony in that to me. And, not that I hope a cloud service provider is going to get breached across the board and all of a sudden, all DNS providers are going to be hit with this level of an attack because it's going to be, coming from these ultra-powerful cloud computing instances. But at the same time, I'm still a little concerned about what's going on with all these different devices, and I'll just leave it at that. I'll put the IoT nightmare on the side for now.
let's see what else we can.
What else we got
about
to talk about? You want to do lightning round real quick?
Sure.
As we wrap up, do you want me to go first? I'll throw out something, and you kind of.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Then
let's do that.
We'll gauge my response to
well.
Your...
Okay, so Peter, you touched on this a little bit this week, I think, and maybe you can give us your opinion and your recap of it. But what went on with the FBI case, the playpen issue, or should we skip that? Is that too sensitive?
Let's pass.
Okay.
Because that goes out of scope, I think.
All right. Let's see. I'll pick. I almost said Mad Cow.
You did that last week.
That last week too. What about Dirty Cow?
Dirty Cow. Yeah. Let's talk about Dirty Cow.
So, what's going on there? How concerned should I be? Where's my concern level at for this?
I'm going to say somewhere between 0 and 10.
0 and 10. Well, obviously, if it's 1 to 10.
Yeah, or 1 to 10, I should say. I think it's something to be concerned about. At first, when we first heard about Dirty Cow, this was a branded vulnerability.
Yes.
With not just with a website and an icon and an image. It also had a Twitter account,
yep,
just dedicated to Dirty Cow.
Yep.
Okay, so I saw a tweet about Dirty Cow basically saying, it's a privilege escalation.
Keep going. I'm just timing.
Right, I see. It's a privilege escalation flaw in Linux. And so what's the big deal? Like, this is one of those over-the-top things. But it turns out, it's a privilege escalation in the kernel, I think. That it means that once you get in there and you escalate your privileges, you can own the system. So I think we'll probably find out more about Dirty Cow next week when we start writing about it. And that's 33 seconds.
Well, we have written about it. But yeah, right. I think, right.
Yes, we did, of course. Michael Keller did.
Yes. So. But yeah, I think you're right. I think there's kind of this ebb and flow of it's bad, it's not that bad, no big deal, and then back to you. It's kind of bad. It's, yeah. You don't want your Linux. I mean, how many servers out there run, data center servers are running Linux?
It's all over the place.
And you get into one and you can up your access like that, thanks to the kernel flaw. Oh, that's not good. Anyway, sorry.
But okay, so. So it's my turn.
Yeah, it's your turn. You pick something and throw it at me.
I'm going to pick something and throw it at you. What do you want to say about the UK came out and admitted for the first time, apparently, that they are now using cyber offensively in the fight against Daesh, ISIS?
Oh, I'm shocked. That's sarcasm.
Thank you.
I just kind of assume that most major governments, most nations have some type of cyber offensive capability or organization or effort underway. It's not a surprise to me that any government that is not aligned with ISIS is using technology, cyber offensive capabilities to their advantage. The thing I'm trying to understand is ISIS or whatever terrorist organizations using social media, like there's not much of a cyber threat from these organizations. So I wonder how much a cyber offensive effort on our part is really going to do, like what it's really going to do to slow them down.
Well, I mean, if they're all using phones and they are all using computers,
sure.
And if let's say they weaponize Dirty Cow, or let's say they weaponize some other,
and
bricked all the terrorist phones, that would be good for us and bad for those
guys. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm thinking of when I think of cyber offensive capabilities, I think of I think of that sort of thing kind of being more along the lines of surveillance, not bricking them, but gaining access to their communications and hacking them. To me, that's different than like a cyber weapon or a cyber bomb that takes all of their systems offline or does something to their critical infrastructure. I mean, really, they don't have critical. I mean, that's part of the advantage, I guess, if we're going to talk about the the art of war. That's part of the advantage of you know, being an organization like that, is that they're harder to target. They don't have critical infrastructure, big targets like that. But, you know, I don't really know what cyber offensive capabilities, cyber weapons is really going to do in this fight. So, I mean, I hopefully will be proven wrong, but yeah. Well,
so I had, as you were talking, I had two thoughts. One was Stuxnet. That was cyber.
Yeah.
Right.
But absolutely.
But the government.
But that's Iran. I mean, that's
against Iran.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, allegedly U.S. and Israel, but neither has ever really come out and said, oh, yeah, we were using cyber. Yeah,
they won't.
But yeah, it, you know, we all kind of, everybody, you know, the Mike Rogers and James Clapper and the rest of those guys can sort of wink and nod.
Sure.
When they answer questions
we
about
don't
it.
Do that,
but we, yeah, but we, you know, we have an idea that that's probably been, you know, if it happened 10 years ago with Stuxnet, that was about 06, was it not?
I think so. I mean, it's been a while.
Right. I mean, that's been a while. So in the interim, we've probably been, this stuff has been used probably before. The other thing is, how would you use cyber against a, you know, an asymmetric force where you don't have a lot of infrastructure? You could take, you know, there's a lot of things you can do to spoof man in the middle,
right,
do things to make the enemy not trust their devices at all.
Sure.
Which would also disrupt them. But anyway, yeah. So you, I guess it's your turn now.
Yeah, let's turn to what's going on with Mozilla.
Oh, yeah, Mozilla's got a lot of stuff going on. Number one, one thing I'm working on for this afternoon is a quick story about how Mozilla is sanctioning WoSign and StartCom, the
yes.
two certificate authorities that were behaving badly. They were doing things like faking SHA-1 certificates so that their customers could keep using SHA-1 even
sure.
after the deadline, you
sure.
know, the drop-dead date for moving away.
But what are the sanctions?
The sanctions
are these like UN sanctions, or
they're, you know, so Mozilla has trusted certificate authorities that they trust,
mm-hmm.
and WoSign had previously been on there, but now they're not, and StartCom neither. So Mozilla laid out what they were going to do in their initial report, which came out, I want to say last month.
I think it was last month.
And I did write about that one. They suggested at the time that doing things like taking WoSign and StartCom off of the list of trusted CAs, and allowing them back only after a year, and only after they've met some conditions. What we found out this week, or actually I think the end of last week, from Mozilla was, or maybe it was the beginning of this week.
I think so.
Monday probably, was that they are going to allow WoSign and StartCom to reapply starting in June of next year. So it's a little bit shorter, but they have to come up with a plan that shows how they're not going to violate any rule and any of the rules.
Plans are good.
They're going to have to implement the plan and have it audited so that it shows that they're actually complying.
No, audits aren't fun.
Right. And that's basically it, but they've basically got to jump through those hoops before they can get back in. They've got to use Google certificate transparency, and they've got to use a non-Google certificate transparency.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that's going on with Mozilla. Another thing that's going on, starting in beginning of next year, I believe it's Firefox version 52, which is slated for, I want to say January, February. Starting then, they're going to default to using TLS 1.3, which, while still in draft form with the IETF, it's not a certified protocol.
It's not allowed
yet.
It's
not an RFC yet.
Yeah.
It's still a draft.
Yep.
But they're gonna start that in next year, which is good. They're gonna still allow fallback to 1.2, which is maybe not so good, but you still, you know, little baby steps.
It's an improvement.
It is an improvement, definitely. And yeah, so that's what's going on with Mozilla. That's a couple of things.
Yeah. Probably more. But
I know that was more than 30 seconds.
Two minutes or whatever. But yeah.
Right. Okay. Oh, so you want to do one more and then we can wrap
things up? Sure, we'll wrap up.
Sure. Maybe the, well, what do you want to talk about?
Hacked emails?
Go for it. That's a, I was thinking that that would be a good one for you to talk
about. Well, let's pretend like you...
Oh, yeah. So Rob, tell me about these hacked emails that we've been hearing.
Well, Peter, let me tell you. When in doubt, just assume that a hack can be attributed to a phishing attempt, because it seems like we all fall for it.
Sophisticated,
no doubt. Yeah. So spear phishing, it looks like there's been news this week that Fancy Bear, in their attacks on the advanced persistent threat group that is tied to Russia, Russian government, Russian threat actors, that they used a spear phishing campaign to target email accounts associated with Hillary Clinton's campaign and other people like Colin Powell. And I just got to say, you know, there's been some reports that kind of went into detail about what the links looked like. In one case with, I believe it was John Podesta, the campaign chair of the Clinton campaign. And I think most people would have fallen for this. So, which is sad. It's troubling. That link, while long and I guess suspicious to someone like myself, I can see most people kind of looking at it and saying, that looks like a legit Google Doc or Google link. I mean, it does. And in your haste and with everything that you're doing day to day, getting an email that looks like it's from somebody that you know, with a link that looks like a legit Google link, clicking on it, and then, you know, hey, you're off to the races. I don't know how much two-factor authentication would have helped in this case. I guess it would have helped prevent having his account, his, you know, Podesta's account taken over completely.
Yeah, I got to jump in here.
Yeah, yeah, so go.
John Podesta,
yes,
forgot his password.
Yeah.
Asked somebody to remind him, and they sent it back to him in email.
Yeah, that's so bad.
Yeah, that's not
good. That's not good. That's not good InfoSec.
Right, right. It's a rookie mistake.
Yeah, but that's the kind of thing that we know now that's become painfully apparent, is that people in government, people in political campaigns, people, heads of industry, enterprises, don't know this sort of thing and really need to be, they really need to be brought up to speed. And that's probably lesson number one. And lesson number two to me would be, or point number two would be, I mean, come on, we put a man on the moon in this country, you know? Like, well, like we sent the Mars rover. We landed that thing on Mars. You know, we're exploring Mars. We've got the technical know-how to do this, but we don't know how to effectively sort of filter out bad links, phishing attempts, come up with some type of system that can protect unsuspecting users from a bad link that maybe I don't know. It's hard for me to believe that something this simple is how a lot of hacking and a lot of data breaches are being done. But that's, Peter, that is the case.
It is.
When in doubt, blame it on phishing. So
sophisticated state actors.
Sophisticated hacks, yeah. Anyway, I guess that probably does it for this week. We covered a lot of ground.
Did we?
Yeah, I think we did.
Yeah.
So it was a good Friday. And, you know, hopefully over Halloween weekend, we're not treated to more catastrophic attacks. Not catastrophic attacks. But you know what I'm saying.
I'll just be glad when we stop getting those pitches for Halloween story, Halloween-oriented scary stories.
Yeah, those are truly the worst.
But are they truly worse than the Thanksgiving ones or the Christmas ones?
I guess that'll be...
We'll find out.
We'll find out. We'll do a podcast episode on that. What's worse? But as usual, Peter, thank you for joining me in our weekly discussion.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And thanks to everyone out there tuning in and reading Search Security. I'm Rob Wright, and we will see you next time.